Hello. I don't know if anyone's actually listening now, but we'll give it a go. Here we go. Good morning, everybody. This is Callum Leslie on the Soapbox, and the first ever show on the Soapbox. Today we're joined by Liberal Democrat 2010 parliamentary candidate, advocate, and Edinburgh University law tutor Fred McIntosh. Fred, hello.
Hello, Callum. Well, congratulations on your new show. It's a bit strange me being here.
Thanks so much. I was first
on Fresh Air in 1997. I feel extremely old.
Well, that's that makes me feel a lot better. 1987, I was five, so I was barely at school. And we are joined by Alex Lukic, but due to microphone problems, I'm not sure. I think his contribution may be limited.
I could just get up close and personal and sort it out.
There you go. We'll try and resolve that as the show goes on. But we're going to start off with a song, just to ease you in gently. We're going to play a bit of The Beatles and Eleanor Rigby. Feeder with Just a Day there. And we're back on the Soapbox with, hopefully, Alex Lukic's mic working properly.
Good morning, everyone. If I talk loud, you might be able to hear me, but that needle is not actually moving much at the moment. That is better, or it was better.
Who knows? That's doesn't seem to actually be working. So, Fred, let's have a discussion without Alex. The first thing we're going to talk about is... it's on a delay. First thing we're going to talk about is we're going to talk about the storm in a bedsheet.
Well, yes. How to embarrass your husband in three easy lessons.
Okay. that's a fairly harsh assessment there by Fred McIntosh, but perhaps fair. For those of you who didn't see it, last week in the London Evening Standard, it was last Thursday, Sally Berkow, the wife of the common speaker John Berkow, was pictured wearing nothing but a bedsheet.
It wasn't just about the bedsheet.
Thoughts, Fred?
I don't want to sound like an aged bufty tufty, but if your partner is doing a big public job with a major constitutional role, it does seem a little enthusiastic to say what she appears to have said and have posed as she definitely posed, and then be surprised that she was done up like a kipper, as she put it in her own tweet later that day.
Absolutely. But I mean, she says that it was part of a wider feature and that it was supposed to be a little bit of fun.
Well, a good story is, I remember when Jo Swinson, the MP for East Dunbartonshire, was first elected, she was contacted by the Daily Sport, I understand, who wanted to a series of tasteful photographs, and she quite properly said no, and I think you have to be aware...
Sorry, the Daily Sport is still a level down from the London Evening Standard.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that, but
brilliant,
the point is that you have to be aware of how people will interpret things. The press has an agenda, it's entitled to one, but you shouldn't be surprised if you are asked to pose stark naked wearing a sheet that someone will take a picture of you doing that.
What I did like...
Not that it happened to me, you understand.
I like that she said, you know, I didn't even know I was going to be in the bed sheet until I got there.
Well, she could say no.
I'm like, you just turn up to do a photo shoot, and a guy asks you to get naked. I don't know what sort of... school she went to, where they taught her that was a good idea.
It's not even that. I mean, I hate to go back to what Nancy Reagan said, but just say no.
But I don't know. She says that she's defended herself, saying she's not the sort of wife who walks dutifully three paces behind her husband and keeps her mouth shut and makes cucumber sandwiches. I like to think there's a middle ground between being naked in a major newspaper.
I've got nothing against cucumber sandwiches, I like them, but there is a long range of possible behaviours between posing semi-naked in a newspaper and making cucumber sandwiches, and perhaps all I'm saying is that maybe if you leap to one end of that line, you shouldn't be surprised if it goes wrong.
Well, I think you've made a point. Lukic, your thoughts, if we can hear them?
Well, I understand Mrs. Berkow has a history of revealing embarrassing secrets about
her personal life.
The interview, it's not just about the bedsheet for me. I think the interview as a whole is actually quite immature, and she's maybe trying to cling on to youth. It's kind of possibly what it looks like, but
It's definitely worked as an attention grab because I didn't even know her name before all this. But I do wonder if she's just, if she is actually like this, or if she's somewhat playing a character just to sort of entertain herself, you know?
Well, I mean, one of the quotes I thought in particular kind of annoyed me was when she was saying that since John became Speaker, the number of women who hit on him has gone up dramatically. But I don't get jealous because more men have hit on me too. So it's some sort of competition.
I mean, I wouldn't want to be too harsh. Speaking as a 40-year-old lawyer who's appearing on a student radio station, holding on to your youth is nothing to be ashamed of. But it does strike me as a little odd, to put it mildly, as an angle to take. And knowing that there are a lot of people, particularly in the right of the Tory party, who really don't like the Speaker, it does seem a bit strange to give them ammunition.
Do you think that she's a liability?
I don't think it's really up to us to determine whether she's a liability. But
it is. We're the commentators, the journalists.
I don't think it helps, is the best way. I don't think it helps him. I mean, I'm not an MP, as you know, and so I'm not in a position to have an influence.
We'll go over that later.
Exactly. But it doesn't seem to be the most helpful thing to happen for somebody who's got a big job to do, and maybe some people think he's not doing it very well.
Yeah, well, he had a fight with Michael Gove the other day, wasn't it? He reprimanded Michael Gove for accusing the Labour Party of rank hypocrisy.
Well, I'm not going to stand up and defend Michael Gove because it really is too much to ask. But I would say that Michael Gove, I think, probably was right. The Labour Party is revelling in rank hypocrisy.
Oh, no.
Lots of people do rank hypocrisy. But just picking that example, you mentioned it. On the day after the Cabinet Secretary's report on the McGrathy release and also this vote on a threshold in the AV referendum in May.
We'll come to next.
Labour seem to have decided they want to max out the hypocrisy. Perhaps they're playing hypocrisy bingo, and they have a card of all the possible hypocritical moves they can make in a week, and they're doing quite well.
What's the prize? That's what I want to know.
The prize is an interview with David Miliband.
Okay, well, we're going to quickly go to another song.
Are we going to know what it's going to be before we play it?
We are going to know what it's going to be. We're not going to accidentally try and play two different songs at once that neither of them are the right song, and then accidentally play another song. You may have noticed that Eleanor Rigby secured wonderfully into Just a Day by Feeder, which was supposed to be the next song. So to make it up to the Beatles, because I feel we've kind of trampled all over them a little bit, we're going to go with George Harrison, "While My Guitar Gently Weeps." When we come back, we'll be talking about the AV referendum, multiculturalism, and anything else we have time for. George Harrison with "While My Guitar Gently Weeps" there. That was a nice little song, a nice sedate song for morning radio rather than Feeder. Sorry about that. That was a bit of an accident. But, you know, it's only the first show.
Eighth effort.
It's first thing in the morning. This is an early evening political discussion show at 10 o'clock in the morning. So you get what you get. So we're going to come on to semi-breaking news. It's broken since Fresh Air last was on the air yesterday, that the government have suffered a defeat in the House of Lords. Fred, do you want to tell us about it?
Yes, this was a vote last night where Labour peer Lord Rooker has set a threshold in the referendum for the alternative vote hopefully in May, that if 40% of the voters don't vote, even if there's a yes vote, it won't pass. And
actually, that's 60. If 60% don't vote, the minimum turnout is 40% for the referendum to be binding.
Yeah, you have to have 40% turnout. And the problem with that is that Labour have... This was in the 1978 Scottish Parliament referendum, which I don't remember because I was eight. But it was described... It's always been, ever since then, considered to be an outrageous affront to democracy that such a threshold was there. It wasn't in the Scottish Parliament referendum or Welsh referendum in 1999. It wasn't in the Northern Ireland referendum, and it wasn't in isn't in the Wales referendum that's next week. But Labour stuck it in here, and I think it just shows that although they had an AV referendum in their manifesto, if they can kick the government, they will do so. And so, without becoming a bore on the topic, I think these new Labour peers are being a little hypocritical.
Can I put forward that the government maybe should have done a little bit better? The government lost the vote by one vote. It was 219 to 218 that we lost the vote.
Yeah, but the problem with the House of Lords is that there isn't a government majority for the coalition. There wasn't a government majority for the Labour government before because of the large number of crossbenchers. And ultimately, the Lords isn't elected. And I think it's something quite weird about unelected people setting a threshold for a referendum to choose how the other parliament, House of Parliament, which is elected, when they've been saying for years, and indeed some of these people who voted for it said when they were MPs that 40% thresholds were a bad idea, because the Tories suggested it in 1997 that there should be a 40% threshold for the Scottish Parliament referendum, and all the Labour MPs then voted against that, including all the people, Tommy McAvoy, Lord Prescott, Lord Reid, all the people who have now voted for it this time. And if you do one thing and then do the exact opposite and can't explain why, I think that's hypocrisy. If you do one thing and do the other and can provide a good rational reason, you might not get agreed with, but at least it makes some sense.
Isn't it a bit... Well, the point, I suppose, the other side of it is that it can be seen as tagging along things like boundary changes and cutting the number of MPs, which I personally would support, but the boundary changes may be not so transparent to a lot of people, and it could be seen as trying to sneak that through on the back of something a lot more positive, yeah, which is a fairer electoral system.
I mean, yeah, obviously there's a deal being done between the Lib Dems and the Tories about this bill, and it has to have two bits to be part of the deal. But to amend the actual terms of the AV referendum is nothing to do with the link, and I think it can't be described as anything other than an attempt to ensure that it's defeated, which from a political party, which oddly was the only political party to stand on a platform of having an AV referendum at all, strikes me as a little odd.
Is there not an argument for this threshold, though? Is there not an argument that if something isn't voted on by 40% of the population, now 40% turnout, that only means that 21%, 20.001 of the electorate percent of the people in this country who can vote have to vote for this to go through. Does that not mean that... I mean, that, surely that's not that difficult, is it?
Well, I think it is. I mean, if you in Scotland, we're lucky that our local elections have happened on the same day as general Scottish Parliament elections for some years. But next year, in 2012, there will be a council election in Scotland, which won't be the same day as a Parliament election. And turnout will be hard in some places to get over 30%. And that's always happened when they've been separate, because people don't see it as important. But that means, effectively, that you can't have referendums other than on the same day as a general election. If people are interested, they will vote. And when I go around canvassing and people say to me, well, I'm not interested, then that's a statement they can make by not voting. If they're against it, they go and vote it. And you can't interpret the people who aren't interested as against something, which is effectively what's being done. Mm.
Do you think the Tories might have actually played a clever game here? Because they don't support AV. They've sort of combined these changes into one bill. And maybe they, you know, had the idea thinking that it could get bogged down in the Lords.
I think one of the things that I've noticed talking to Liberal Democrat peers in the last few weeks is how angry...
Name-dropping alert.
I'm not going to drop any individual peers, but it's the way they report that the anger from Tory peers, old-style Tory peers, who rather liked the sort of genial old boys club sort of style of the House of Lords, being damaged by the arrival of some Labour people, including Lord McAvoy, who, of course, never said anything in the House of Commons because he was a whip, has now never stopped talking. And they feel that these new Labour peers are causing... I don't mean new Labour in the Tony Blair sense. These new...
Yeah.
These new Labour peers are changing the House of Lords. And I think that's good. It needs to be changed. But the anger from the Tories is quite high. So I would be surprised if now they wanted anything other than to get this bill through. Maybe... back in the summer of last year, there would have been some who'd have that thought you suggested. But ultimately, I think it's anger at Labour now that's the main motivating factor in the government.
Okay. Like I say, do you not think maybe the government could have done a little bit better, got two more peers? I'm sure there were two Liberal Democrat and Tory peers who weren't there.
Well, I'm sure the government will be asking that question, and the government whips, both Liberal Democrat and Conservative, will be asking that question. When it goes back to the Commons, as it will do after report stage, there will no doubt be an attempt to reverse it. It will be interesting to see what then happens to the timing of the bill, but it looks like an attempt to prevent the referendum happening on the 5th of May from Labour, which I think is a bit cheap.
It will be interesting to see what happens when it goes back to the Commons with the Labour Party, who so didn't support a threshold for other referendums, to see if they are going to support it now for this other referendum that they a referendum they actually support more than anyone else, or they should do. But you've got people like Tom Harris, the MP for Glasgow South, gloating on Twitter this morning that he was pleased the threshold amendment got through, and that he heard Nick Clegg was spitting teeth, and he was gleefully reporting this.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the problems that we get in politics is this issue that politicians say one thing and do another, and all politicians do that at times, and I'm sure we'll come to various examples. But this particular one is very, very indicative, because there's no financial issue here. There's nothing. There's no big pressure on these Labour peers to make them change their mind. They've just done it out of just spite. I think basically, yeah, they don't want something they were campaigning for to happen because somebody else is going to do it. And I do feel, and perhaps I would say this, but a lot of the anger from Labour about the Liberal Democrats in government is a sense of outrage that these little people, who frankly should do what they're told, are supporting the other guy, and they're behaving very, very hypocritically, and that should be noticed.
I do think, to an extent, the Labour peers are acting defensively for their party, but to an extent, it is definitely just a knock at the government.
It does seem strange, though, that Labour are attempting to get one up on the coalition by proving that they don't live up to their manifesto. But their argument is that the constituencies and boundaries part should be separated, and they've said all along that they would support the EV referendum through the Lords easily if the government agreed to put constituencies and boundaries and cutting the number of MPs into a separate bill. Do you think that perhaps the government should have taken that deal? Would that have been an easy way to go? But then perhaps would the second bill have fallen and that would have caused trouble for the coalition?
I think you have to remember that the reduction of MPs was both in the Conservative and Liberal Democrat manifestos. The reductions are at different scales. I forget which was more. But when you had the House of Lords blocking a proposal that was in the manifesto of both government parties, and there are not a lot of things that were in both manifestos, it does raise the question of the Parliament Act and the fact we need to be moving on to electing the House of Lords. Because with an elected House of Lords, we wouldn't be having this discussion on these terms. It would be about electoral mandates, which it should be about. These people are not elected. People who in this country in the UK voted by a significant majority for manifestos that supported reducing the number of MPs. So ultimately, the House of Lords needs to stand aside. That's what we were saying in 1906 and 1909, and we're saying it now.
I think that's part of the problem about the House of Lords for commentators such as us, that it's because of the amount of crossbenchers and the bishops and the fact that, as you say,
the bishops. What are the bishops doing there?
Well, that's a separate issue. But the fact that no government really has a majority because of the crossbenchers, you can never tell what the House of Lords is going to do. And also because they're all old and
they're very clever people.
Things, and they don't always go. And because the turnout is so variable.
The House of Lords only works if everyone in it assumes that it's never going to ultimately stand up to the government, except on blatant human rights type issues, major issues of principle that have just come out of the woodwork. If the House of Lords starts standing up to the government on manifesto points, which is what happened in 1906 and caused the Parliament Act, then we'll have to have another Parliament Act, and let's have an elected upper house and get rid of all the appointed and life peers, just like Labour said in 1997.
Well, let's hope that happens. That's obviously that's part of that is in the coalition agreement, and it's a Liberal Democrat and Labour held principle. Obviously, the Conservatives aren't really going to support getting rid of the old boys' club, but we'll have to see how
that
goes.
They would in 2001.
Of course. Well, you know, everyone says everything to get elected these days.
Well, indeed,
let's,
yes.
Let's not talk about pledges.
let's talk about pledges.
we're gonna do another song, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about David Cameron's speech on multiculturalism to the security conference in Germany this past weekend. This next song is Joe Jackson with Is She Really Going Out With Him? Joe Jackson with Is She Really Going Out With Him? And Fred commented during the break there that most of my music is older than me, which is very nice of him. But, you know, it's not older than him. So, yeah, joke's on him. So we're now going to come to David Cameron's speech to the German Security Conference at the weekend on multiculturalism, where David Cameron said that state multiculturalism had failed. Now, this has provoked a lot of controversy from the sort of man in the street, mostly actually, sort of saying that Sadiq Khan in particular, the Labour MP, accused him of writing propaganda for the English Defence League. There's also been a lot of talk of the timing, given that there was a massive protest in Luton by the English Defence League. And so, Lukic, let's come to you first. What were your thoughts on the speech, and then sort of what were your thoughts on the reaction?
Well, I mean, I myself come from a place many would consider to be multicultural, urban West Yorkshire, a great mix of cultures. And from my perspective on things...
I'm going to move the spinning chair from the studio, because Amel does that as well.
It's this particular chair here. You just can't help but spin on it. When I'm sat over the other side of the table there, I've no problem.
I've seen Amel do a full 360 degrees while trying to talk in the microphone. It's ridiculous.
This is radio, of course.
Yeah. Yes.
Anyway, what I was saying was, I was about this idea of state multiculturalism, as if it's something that the state have deliberately made happen, that people naturally live around people of their own race. You tend to find that is because people are generally more comfortable doing that. I don't think it's any particular government experiment. However, I do think that quite often society isn't actually welcoming enough of people. I know some people say that they're too welcoming, and I understand where they're coming from. You see things like councils printing leaflets in about 30 different languages and things like that. And I don't actually class that as welcoming people. I think that is pointing at people and saying, look, you're different. You're not actually a part of our mainstream society.
Well, there's a sort of... I'm unashamedly going to say, I spoke to my mother about this, because my mother's a religious education lecturer at Dundee University and has done many community interfaith projects. And what she told me was that multiculturalism is dead. Multiculturalism hasn't been used by the interfaith community to sort of do anything for the past few years, for many years, in fact, because multiculturalism in that sort of meaning means that everyone can have their own little community, their own little bit of it, and not integrate with other communities. So it's essentially saying that in every town there can be a Muslim area, a Sikh area, a Christian area, and whatever, and that those communities don't have to interact with each other, and that doesn't help community cohesion.
No, it causes a lot of tension, because people are always wondering that it's like a closed shop. All the other communities in their area, and these are on their doorstep, so they can sometimes feel threatened.
I do wonder though if that's maybe not what David Cameron meant, because he did go on to take quite a bit of a swipe at the Muslim community, saying that the Muslim community, you know, it's almost like what Jack Straw said a few weeks ago, that the Muslim community has a problem with the way some of its members is behaving. Was saying
and can sometimes be tolerant maybe of certain extreme views and not do enough to drive those out of their mainstream community.
I certainly don't agree with what David Cameron said about not sharing a platform with extreme groups and the people like the BNP and the English Defence League. I think that's something that personally I've opposed. I know the student union and everyone around the university is opposed to no platform. That's the only way you can show these people up to be what they are is by engaging with them. Fred, what was your take on the speech?
Well, I thought the first thing that interested me as a lawyer is that it's very dangerous when you use language that you think has one meaning, but the audience is going to interpret having a different meaning.
And particularly in Germany.
Perhaps. But this speech was in English, and the multiculturalism means a lot of different things to different people. And I think it's interesting to compare some of the things that David Cameron said, which are probably in the deeper meaning of his speech, and the way it was reported. He said that we should ask questions of organizations that we fund about their attitude to other minorities, religious, ethnic, what they think about the rule of law, democracy, and the sort of broad brush of European civilization in that sense. And I think that's a good point. We shouldn't be funding organizations that don't believe that others have a right to their own conscience, that are not in favor of women having equal rights and not in favor of democracy. But multiculturalism always exists. Immigrant communities arrive, they often stay in one place, it's easier, and also they suffer economic disadvantage, so it's easier to be with people you know. And I was brought up in South London in the 80s, and there were a lot of West Indian Caribbean people living in Brixton, and it was a place that they congregated in because maybe they knew people there, and there was a lot of economic discrimination against them, and so perhaps you can appreciate that. But it's also worth saying that no one goes around anymore complaining about how the Huguenots are moving into our area and dropping house prices. Times change, and immigrant communities move on, and I think we must be careful of expecting communities that come into Britain, and we want to welcome them, they're not going to be able to integrate too quickly. It will take generations in some cases, especially if the language and cultural differences are major. But, and we have to tolerate that, we have to accept that people will want to speak in their own language, at least at home, and they will end up, because of economics, living with people who they can speak to, and who they have an understanding with, and perhaps know where they've come from, and understand their life histories and their skills. But at the same time, I think David Cameron was right to say, at the end of the day, you have to set some standards, particularly when you give public funding to organisations, that they should tolerate each other's, they should not discriminate against women, and they should accept that democracy has a role.
Something that did worry me, though, about the speech was, it's not just about multiculturalism and communities sort of integrating, like you said, or communicating. Something he said was that he was saying that it's about people who come here having to accept a certain number of British values. It always slightly bothers me when people talk about British values, because what do we mean by British values? We mean fairness, we mean decency, we mean...
Do we mean Tory values?
When we're talking about British values, when we ask people what they mean, they generally talk about things like fairness, like tolerance, like decency. And I'm wondering what makes those exclusive to Britain?
I don't think they are. I think that they also can be interpreted relative to your concept of the world, your mental map of the world. And I'm sure if you spoke and got through the language barrier and the cultural barrier to some people who hold some particularly extreme views in Afghanistan, they would say that they operate fairly. And they would say they operate decently. Of course, we wouldn't see it that way, and rightly so. But you've got to remember that there's a difference between legal absolutes and values. And this idea that you can legislate for values, which was a big Jack Straw New Labour thing, it's a shame to see the Tories trying to legislate for values. I hoped they'd got away from that. But you can't make people hold your values. You can make people follow the law, but that's different.
I think, though, it is quite important to... I don't think we do currently have an English language requirement for immigration, do we? But I think this is actually very important, because I don't think you can reasonably expect people to feel comfortable in a society if they don't speak the language spoken by the majority.
We can't possibly have an English language requirement. We're a member of a 350 million people single market with 18 different principal languages. We can't tell Polish people, if they don't speak English, that they can't come to England. So if we can we still tell
Pakistanis? Well, can we tell Indians?
On one level, what will be the point? I mean, why? It's the same thing with the immigration fight the Tories are currently having with Vince Cable. You can't stop UK immigration and put it back to some weird 1930s environment absolutely without realising that the European Union, we are part of a single market, we do well out of it. Europe is a very important thing for Britain, it's very good for us. Just a place like Edinburgh wouldn't exist, this university, without a free market in education and the movement of students.
And the other argument of that is that if you look at the huge number of expat communities in Asia and in the Middle East, even in some places, the places that aren't on fire, there is a huge British expat community. And a lot of them don't speak the language.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we started saying that you can't come from India to Britain if you don't speak British English, it might be hard for some British people to go there if they don't, say, speak Hindi or other whatever particular language.
No, I was going to say, going to India is not as simple as speaking one language.
Well, indeed, and we've just cut the Hindi service, the World Service, so maybe it's a bit of a complex issue.
The World Service, where did it all go wrong?
There wasn't any money left, I think you'll find.
I did sense a hint of hypocrisy in David Cameron's words, actually saying specifically or implying that state multiculturalism has failed, when the co-chairman of the Conservative Party, Government Minister Baroness Warsi, actually lost an election in my hometown of Dewsbury 5 years ago, or nearly 6 years ago. and has risen up the ranks and become a peer since then. Complete, and it can't be based on performance, really, well, can this, it? Considering this, she lost an election, yeah. And the swing went against.
Well, I think
the
you're
Tories.
Being a bit harsh on people who lose elections there.
I think that, I mean, this is the same Baroness Barzi that a few weeks ago said that casual racism had become acceptable at the dinner party. And that was possibly.
I think probably it has.
Slightly, this is a follow on from that.
I think we are a very racist society still, and it takes a long time to change it. People are always afraid of the other and different. And yeah, it's got better, I'm sure. I say that as a white, middle class, public school educated lawyer. But it has got better since the 80s. But we have to keep alive to it. And just, it's an obligation on us as Western liberals, to try and not be racist.
Generally liberals.
With a small L.
I was going to say. So we're going to come back to that, possibly, later on in the run of the show, maybe in future weeks. I think this is possibly going to run on and on. Now, I do have to apologise to some people I know who are listening, or possibly listening. This was supposed to be the feature of the show called Something to Shout About, where a new band gets to feature their music on this well-listened to radio show, but unfortunately I've come in this morning and they've changed the computer setup, so I've not been able to get my own music on here. So instead, I know that my friend Alistair was in this band, the Glitch, who are absolutely fantastic. They were playing at Maggie's Chambers on Saturday night in the Three Sisters, and they were absolutely excellent. If you're in the Fife area, you can check them out at Rock the Heroes. But I know he's a big fan of the John Butler Trio, so we're going to go with the John Butler Trio and Better Than, and hopefully next week I'll be able to bring you the Glitch. That was the John Butler Trio with Better Than, and we're coming to the end of the hour now. It's 10:51. We're going to go round the table and talk about the stories we've brought in. We've brought in something for show and tell. So what have you brought in, Fred?
Well, I'm becoming a grumpy old man, so I've brought in a story from the Sunday Telegraph, which I don't normally read, but turns out that the BBC guy, who's going to be David Cameron's new spin doctor, has been arranging his tax affairs in a perfectly legal way, so he doesn't pay too much tax, which is strange. And in not any way, in my view, particularly odd, especially when the Daily Telegraph is owned by people who are based offshore on the Channel Islands. And I stopped buying newspapers, is what I'm trying to say most of the time. I read things on the internet. I get quite cross when newspapers apply a spin to their stories and then that are directly contrary to their own owner's general approach to life. It does seem a little, frankly, cheeky.
So you don't read newspapers anymore?
I do occasionally when I buy them, see them at work, and I read them on the internet.
I read The Student, I have to say.
I've stopped reading The Student recently. It was one of the I've taken a sabbatical from student newspapers.
Can I just say, if you can find a copy of last week's Student, I know the new one comes out today, but last week's Student, and they're friends of mine, but it had a frankly hilarious picture of all of our sabbatical officers' heads on the bodies of the girls from Sex and the City, in an article about the sabbatical's recent holiday to New York, which was a complete non-story.
Why did the sabbatical's go on holiday to New York?
We'll talk about that later. We'll talk about that off air.
Presumably you used some money, you didn't pay for it.
No, they went on holiday. Oh, right, End of story. That's kind of all it needed to be said. But yeah, so we've got the Daily Telegraph here being hypocritical. The media being
hypocritical.
It's not
really news, I know, but
is that a news
it attracted me. The other thing I wanted to mention was, of course, the stuff we haven't mentioned is the McGrathy report from yesterday, which, as a lawyer, of course, is instantly fascinating. It may not necessarily be fascinating to everybody else, but the fact that Gordon Brown was announcing that it was outrageous that Mr. McGrathy had been released having, trying to arrange it to happen for the previous 6 months to a year, is just takes the biscuit. And I think there are going to be a lot of angry people when they realise exactly what they were told by Labour turned out to be complete mince. Not that that's news either, but there we are.
Fair enough. Alex, what have you brought with you?
I've brought something slightly more substantial, although not exactly surprising, being that a Liverpool council, being Lib Dem previously and gone to Labour in the last election, has rejected the big society idea, the vanguard policy of the Conservative Party, basically accusing the Conservatives somewhat of hypocrism. I'm probably
hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy. That's it.
It's still early.
When you're on air, this happens. But it's just they're saying that, you know, the Tories are making cuts to their budgets and so they can't support as many volunteer groups, and yet they're claiming to empower local people to volunteer and run their services. I'm not entirely sure people want to run local services. I think most people just want to be listened to and have their services run in an open way that benefits the community. We could be creating a fraternity of meddlers, the whole big society idea.
But there is obviously another part to this big society story that's come out in the last few days, was that a number of charities have expressed concern with the way the cuts are affecting the way the big society can work. And a lot of these charities were saying that with the public spending cuts, it's meaning that people aren't able to volunteer, and these organisations aren't able to function in a way that would fulfil the big society.
Well, I find that the big society, I just find it sounds like a think tank's idea. And if you remember when it was initially announced by David Cameron, it was about decontaminating the Tory brand. It's always going to be hard to encourage volunteering in the middle of a series of deficit cuts, and we have to do it. But I do think that the language of the Conservative Party really did expose them to this happening. Equally, I was very surprised when Labour Liverpool signed up to the whole thing in the summer. I do wonder whether they signed up for it in order to then leave it a little bit later. We have a huge public deficit. We're paying £120 million a day in interest payments. It has to be sorted. Perhaps some things, like the big society, some of the more complex parts of it might have had to have waited. And maybe Mr Cameron's losing out because they're trying to do too much at once.
I've got to give some credit to the Tories for actually trying something fairly radical here. It could could drop like a lead balloon, or it could actually be very successful. I think personally, whenever Labour get back in, they'll just scrap the whole idea, much like the Tories have scrapped a lot of Labour policies, department names, changing everything back the way it was, which just seems to be what happens after an election. But I hope it will encourage more big ideas in government, at least, about actually changing the way things work, because some people just want to see some sort of change, no matter what it is.
I brought a different story with me. I brought a story that was actually relating to Scotland, which is a first for this hour.
Wow.
In the last couple of minutes, we're going to talk about... I wanted to talk about North Ayrshire Council. Let's bring it local.
We're not in North Ayrshire.
North Ayrshire Council has suggested that they might move in, and for no other reason than as a public spending cut, they might move from a 5-day school week to a 4-day school week. Now, I spoke to Councillor Andrew Chamberlain from North Ayrshire Council, who told me that this was potentially unavoidable, that they tried to prioritise education spending, but at the end of the day, it was a major expenditure that needed to be cut in some way. However, having spoken to Alan Robertson from Voice of the Union, I've done a bit of investigative journalism here with 3 minutes to go. he said that the school has a commitment to a certain number of days schooling, which actually North Ayrshire is not that far above that threshold. So if it cuts a day a week, it's going to have to add in days and add in hours elsewhere. So it's not actually, he didn't see where the saving was potentially. In maybe 2.5 minutes, does anyone have an opinion?
Yeah, Edinburgh runs a strange school week, which initially, I'm a parent, I thought was a bit odd, but actually works quite well.
So what is the school week in
Edinburgh? Edinburgh school week starts at 10 to 9, and it finishes for children over the age of 7 at 20 past 3, Monday through to Thursday, which is a bit later than most schools. Most schools in most of the country finish a little bit earlier than that, like half an hour, 40 minutes earlier. But on Fridays, it stops at noon. Now, it's great if you're self-employed or you work part-time, because it means you get a bit of family time on a Friday afternoon. Of course, it's complete hell if you're working a full-time job. But the school week is a complete hell if you're working a full-time job anyway. And I think the Edinburgh solution, which was negotiated years ago as part of a deal with the unions in the 80s, might be something that North Ayrshire should look at before they look at something as radical as 4 days a week. And bonds of time for nurseries in North Ayrshire, who will of course be full of parents paying through the nose for childcare so they can go to work on a Friday.
I think, well, my angle on it is parents will definitely suffer if they were to implement a 4-day week purely due to childcare costs.
Yeah, it's going to cost parents a lot more money.
I'm very much aware of the Edinburgh School Week, because actually a lot of schools play their sport on a Friday afternoon after they've finished for the day, and a referee football.
Let's not get into football yet.
Yeah, I'm on later. We've still got.
We'll come into that. I'll plug it. Yes, look at Janelle. We'll be back on your radios, you lucky, lucky people. We'll be back on the radio at 4 o'clock this afternoon with the return of the commentary box with Davey Heaton, and we'll be joined by Shug as well.
Yeah,
he'll be joining us from...
for the Motherwell angle.
For the Motherwell angle, and the big, big, tall ginger guy angle. So, to sum up, what do you think are going to be the big news stories of the week in... 20 seconds, Fred McIntosh.
Well, I think there will be almost certainly be stories flowing on from this House of Lords vote. Of course, we'll see what happens in Egypt. It looks like the revolution is fading out, which is a great shame. That will be, I think, the story of the spring. It still might be our 1989 moment, and we have to hope for some developments in Egypt.
And in 15 seconds, Lukic, the news stories of the next week.
I think it'll be a slow news week. I think we'll hear a lot of SNP moaning about how they were defeated at Holyrood again, and as you say, follow on from Egypt and the AV vote. I don't think much else will happen.
I just hope everybody's going to get along. So thank you for joining us on the first ever Soapbox. We'll be back again next week at 10 o'clock, when my guest will be someone who I've managed to drag in, and we're going to finish up with Ash and Burn Baby Burn.